We start today's program with Arizona's 6th District Congressman, David Schweikert, who's part of the House Freedom Caucus that's being given credit and blame for House Speaker John Boehner's decision to step away from Congress. Congressman Schweikert, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Steve.
So why are we at this point in terms of who will be the next speaker?
I think actually one of the underpinnings that's actually happening is actually more of a reform agenda. There's great frustration among many members and from the ideological spectrum. You're frozen out from being able to offer amendments, for being able to actually produce intellectual capital and have it properly debated. So yes, the House Freedom Caucus is, you know, fixated on by some, but often those some that are doing it are the very ones that have been controlling the process and freezing out the rest of the membership.
So based on what you've said, it sounds like you want something pretty clear from the next speaker. Anything else you didn't bring up? What about a broader sense of things in terms of how assignments are doled out, how he works with the other party?
Steve, you actually get it. It's and I don't mean this to sound rhetorical, but it really is policies, procedure, and then access to something we call the steering committee. Picture this. The House has a set of rules on how legislation moves through the body. But every time it gets to the Rules Committee, they rewrite the very rules for that specific piece of legislation to control it, to freeze out members from the right to left, whatever you may be, reformers, from even being able to debate and offer amendments. And this is moving up and down through the process. So there's just this sense of frustration. You get elected to legislate, and you're frozen out from being able to do that job.
So is that just not sexy enough for people to talk about?
It's complicated. So I see a lot of very, and look, it would never happen on KJAZ. That's one of the reasons I love this station. But much of the reporting, both in print and electronic, is absolutely trite. They see it as a horse race for who the next speaker is. For many of us, it's not about the person. It is about the policy changes that allow us to legislate.
We've heard from a couple of listeners at this point who, now, you tend to be someone who really is enthusiastic about the policy, the process, and not everyone is. So, but we're definitely getting the impression from some of our listeners, they've heard you say this whole thing has been kind of fun. And I think some people are nervous that they're wondering, is fun going to lead to a government shutdown?
Yeah, and I think that's an absurd. There was a hit last year when, or 2 years ago, when I said being on national NPR, it was my idea of fun. And a couple of the professional political hitmen in town said, oh, he thinks getting against a shutdown is fun. No, it's absolutely absurd. But what's absurd is many of us have proposals that I believe are intellectually credible, well vetted, to avoid these types of things. We've had the Debt Ceiling Alternative Act, that yes, you have to raise the debt ceiling. Yes, you probably would exempt interest, but there's stunning numbers of cash assets and other things sitting idle that also should be swept. Just the ability to discuss these mechanisms out there, you're frozen out. So that's one of the reasons you love a longer format like this where you can talk about it. But if you're, you know, let's face it, the chattering class, where a hit on Twitter is your idea of fun, something with policy implications is beyond what you're capable of talking about.
You know, there's skepticism, David, about whether anyone can actually lead this body because, as you mentioned, there are people who want different things. There are some people who are more about process. Some are about policy. Mm-hmm. Some are about assignments. So is there a person there, regardless of a name or not? I don't think we have to get into that necessarily. Yeah. But is there someone that can really, you know, get everyone sort of at least on the same page in the right direction, even if we're going to disagree about certain things, we can agree this is how this body needs to be run?
Yeah, Steve, there absolutely is. But once again, the fastest way to get camaraderie from the reformers and those who want to defend the establishment as it is give everyone a voice. And we had a really good example of this on Friday. There was a piece of legislation in regards to crude oil exports. Within that were some earmarks that for many of us were very difficult, but we were allowed amendments to try to change them. Now, we lost those amendments, but because we had a voice, because we had a chance to debate it, we voted yes on the final bill because the final bill was in totality a good thing. That was an example of vesting members to have a voice makes it a lot easier to come together and move forward on legislation.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with Arizona Congressman David Schweikert. Congressman, does it feel to you, the public seems to think this, that members of Congress, the president as well, keep going from mini crisis to mini crisis, the budget, the debt ceiling, et cetera. Is that a fair characterization?
Oh, absolutely fair.
And so, is there momentum to change that?
I think there is, but you have to actually have a process where, I have a fixation on debt and how to manage it and how to finance and survive, let's face it, our demographic bubble. The ability to be able to bring somewhat complicated ideas in front of your subcommittee, in front of a committee, and move them through the process, I believe will get ahead of the next inflection point that's perceived as a crisis. Also, I must tell you, the way things get reported, the shrillness of the reporting is often much more dramatic than actually what's happening in the legislative body itself.
You have called it political theater before. So is the theatrics out in the public, and in private there's actually more, let's say, down-to-earth work being done?
Yeah. I mean, think about it. How many headlines are, how many, if you watch cable news, the crisis in the House, the frozen fight, the this and that, nothing's getting done. Well, that isn't true. We are still marching along with our legislative calendar. We, just as we just talked about on Friday, we passed actually a very big bill. It's moving on. Legislative bodies are actually supposed to be somewhat cantankerous. That is the purifying effect. And look, if you're not comfortable with conflict, don't watch your state legislature, don't watch the U.S. House. It is actually designed that way. But ultimately, if you have an open, egalitarian process where everyone has a voice, you eventually come together and there is your compromise.
So ultimately, John Boehner's decision to step down and this whole process, whether it's Representative McCarthy or whoever else, this should be something that we as Americans should be heartened by in some way?
No, I think actually Americans should just understand it is the process.
Okay.
It is the process we've been given, and sometimes the discomfort is actually what brings us to refining the system. You almost have to go through, and legislative processes and businesses and universities have this history of, over time, moving to sort of a consolidation of authority and then moving back to a diminution of that authority and making it spread across the body. We're in that inflection right now where over the last few years there's been this tremendous consolidation, and it really isn't it's beyond the speaker. It's just a handful of what we call the cardinals, the people who control the key committees. Mm-hmm. And now what we're asking for is maybe allow everyone to participate in the legislative process.
You have been, as you mentioned, someone who's focused a lot on debt and our deficits and whatnot. The economy has certainly gotten a lot better over the last few years, but there are still a lot of people who aren't working as much as they want to. Certainly wages have not gone up. So do you think if there was more of a commitment to reducing debt and deficits, that would make people more comfortable with going ahead as far as hiring is concerned? We also, though, we've talked about interest rates in the past before. We also have people who aren't really saving because there's no reason to save.
Yeah, correct. In many ways, the focus on debt and deficits is the end of the tunnel. At the beginning of the tunnel is, what do you do to have a vibrant economy? What do you do to come to a rational regulatory world and start to embrace modern technology in that regulatory world and information as part of the way we regulate? And there's going to be other things. You're going to have to be willing to take on an immigration system that focuses on economic growth. And that would be very uncomfortable for many who aren't ready to see that type of revolution. But you do everything. And then the toughest part of all for those in the political class is an honest conversation of what's about to happen in the entitlements, in the earned benefits, in the formula driven. In about 5-6 months, Social Security disability, that particular trust fund, will be empty. And it's the very first in the domino of the trust funds running out of their cash.
So what should these presidential candidates, what should members of Congress be doing to talk about that? Because when you say it like that in a calm voice, then it sounds like something needs to be worked out. But if it becomes the hype machine, then...
Exactly. Look, there's ways to do this, but it's the type of meeting you have over a calculator and policy sheets, not necessarily behind a podium trying to belittle your opponent. And look, we've done 100 plus town halls showing budget numbers and those things. And I've been heartened because we've had from the progressive Democrats to the libertarians who are there to digest what's really going on financially. But you always have the person that sees it more as theater and not as math. If you care about the poor, if you care about the economic future, if you care about your kids, there are solutions, but you've got to be willing to engage in the intellectual capital to do the tough things.
That's a lot of work. I imagine that's even harder in the House when it's a two-year term. Have you given serious thought, whether it's to challenge John McCain or anyone else, have you given serious thought to whether if you were in the Senate, you could have a bigger impact being one of 100?
Look, if you're in the Senate, you have a much louder voice. Part of that is just the rules and the nature of it and the six-year term. But I really like being married, and as you know, we've been working on a family. So sometimes the delusions of grandeur get you in trouble with your spouse.
Well, you were always known for having a dog. Good luck with having a child. Hope that works out well for you.
Well, that will be for our next conversation.
Okay. And finally, before you go, the Democratic presidential debate was last night. Any of the Republicans you're excited about at this point?
This is a sort of a global observation. I'm actually excited by the standpoint that the Republicans have an interesting set of voices. Some are very establishment. Some are very reform. Some are, older, younger. But if you actually look at it compared to the Democrats, think of this. The median age is dramatically younger on the Republican side. The diversity is more so on the Republican side. And the creativity of the variety of opinions, I think, is much better on the Republican side. I'm hoping this starts to lead to sort of new voices coming out of my party.
Arizona's 6th District Congressman David Schweikert. Congressman, thank you as always.
No, this is my idea of fun. I enjoy these conversations.
Take care. Still to come on Here and Now, we'll hear about K-12 education funding in Arizona, and later this hour, conversation with Arizona's Poet Laureate Alberto Rios. Stay with us. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A lot of plans for how to fund Arizona's K-12 schools have been making headlines in recent weeks. Governor Doug Ducey wants to use more funds from the state land trust. Republican legislative leaders are interested in using money from the First Things First Early Childhood and Health Development Program. Legislative Democrats are calling for using a $325 million surplus from the last budget year and an anticipated $250 million annual surplus for the foreseeable future. So what do all of these proposals say about K-12 education and, more specifically, the funding in Arizona? It seems that not all that long ago there was disagreement over whether the state really did need to put a lot more money into education, but now the conversation has shifted to just how much more should be spent. With me to explore this more deeply are former Arizona State School Superintendent Lisa Graham Keegan and former state lawmaker Rich Crandall, who is also head of the Wyoming Department of Education. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
So, Lisa, does it feel to you like the conversation has fundamentally shifted?
It definitely has, Steve, and you've typified it exactly correctly, I think, that there's a consensus on all parties. The other day, the Capital Times ran a story on education funding plans, and all of them significantly increased the amount of money we're supporting our schools with. So now we're just haggling over price.
Rich, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd have to agree completely with Lisa on that comment. And we're starting to see indications that a low level of funding is having some long-term impact, whether it's on buildings and maintenance. But probably the biggest bellwether for me is the number of long-term subs, especially in rural schools, whether it's charters or districts. And that's really starting to make people wake up and say, holy, maybe we need to really do something on the financial side.
Rich is one of those people who is considered to be in that moderate wing of the state legislature, moderate Republican wing. Are you surprised that some of the legislative leaders, those that maybe in the past had been a little bit more tentative, in fact, continuing with the lawsuit, are you surprised that they are being more forward about this?
Yeah, like you asked, Lisa, the conversation has shifted. Everybody is agreeing that, yes, there needs to be more money put into K-12. And like Lisa said, now how much are we talking about?
Yeah, Lisa, let's talk about a little bit about these plans. We don't have a lot of time. I don't want to get too specific on these, but is there anything there? I know you've worked with Governor Ducey in the past. Is there anything about the plans that we've heard, whether it's Governor Ducey, Republican leaders, Democrats, or even what Superintendent Douglas has said? Are there certain combinations of things you really like as top priorities?
Well, I think the biggest priority, Steve, is to get an initial amount as quickly as possible back into base funding. So that means it we're talking anywhere from about, according to the different plans, $300 per pupil all the way up to, I don't know, it depends whose plans you're looking at. It looks like, ironically, the legislator's plan is the most expensive. But they're coming at it by dumping some other funds that I think probably wouldn't be politically palatable, but that might be around $400 a student. So we're talking about a pretty significant amount, probably part of that sort of to make up for what was not done in the past. And as you know, Steve, we've got negotiations going on over the lawsuit that's active right now over how much the state kind of owes in arrears. And by all accounts, the governor has intervened here, is offering some leadership, and everybody I talk to is greatly appreciative about that. Nobody knows what's going on there, and I have to say, for once in a political world, that is a very well-kept secret. Secrets are going to die among the negotiators there. I don't know about you, Rich, but nobody knows, and this is highly unusual for educators. We usually like to chat about these things. All I'm hearing is that it's going well. I don't know about you, Rich.
You bet. So some of the, some of the rumors that are out there, and it's very interesting to see, as you talk about what has been tried in the past, what works, what doesn't. The ideas that you simply take from the rainy day fund or that you simply take from the general fund, in the long term, that's not a solution. Hey, we're doing well right now. We've got so many hundreds of millions in a rainy day. Let's use that to fix K-12 education. Okay, that works for 2 years, 3 years. So as you look long term, Governor Ducey's done a good job with the state trust land. I think he's a little high, and I think people are starting to realize that, the 10% for 5 years, then 5% after that. I think you're going to see some kind of a lower level come down, maybe at 6%, 7%. Who knows? Maybe it's even 5% for 10 years of that state trust land, and people are going to start to get on that idea. One thing Lisa alluded to was the political correctness of the legislative plan. There's not a snowflake's chance that you're going to be able to get voters to take 0-5 money and give it to K-12 and rob from the first things first. Wouldn't happen in Arizona.
Yeah, Lisa, no. Is that what you're referring to there?
It's exactly what I'm referring to, and I agree with Rich. As a matter of fact, it's been tried before. I mean, the public feel strongly about this, and they voted for it, and they've upheld it, and it's going to stay there. So I like the way Governor Ducey's state land trust plan came out in the beginning. One of the things legislators said at the time that we're supporting or are supporting, Texas has oil, we have land. Now, it's my belief that as the economy bounces back, those land values are going to go up, and therefore the trust, our ability to take money from that trust and still have an increase in value, as the governor says, after 10 years is present. And the present value of that in a classroom is much higher. I would also argue that you educate students for 10 years at a higher level, and you're getting an economic return that's quite significant. So I really believe that state land trust is a primary piece of what's about to happen. The other discussion that's going on, Steve, is the Classrooms First, which is a complete reorganization of the way that we fund our schools. Haven't done it since 1980, since before there were fax machines. And that is really dealing with the quality piece of this. How do we create a formula that's equitable and drives excellence? So there's a lot going on at the same time.
Yeah, Rich, I want to come back to initially the premise of this, which is, because you've both made interesting points about this, but when you think about the conversation shifting, is this a case where lawmakers or the governor, when he was running for office at this point, heard from a lot of folks, let's say in business, who were saying, we can talk about this, but we're really looking at the key numbers, that Arizona should be growing faster than it is. And one of the reasons maybe it's not, maybe it hasn't bounced back quite as much from the recession, is because businesses just don't want to move here. We have to improve education now.
One of the benefits I have is that short amount of time I spent in Wyoming, where Wyoming spends $19,000 per pupil because the five largest coal mines in North America are in Wyoming. So they had plenty of money, and it was interesting to compare and contrast Wyoming with its 92,000 students and a $1 billion budget, and then come back to Arizona. Arizona has so many unique challenges, and yet we do not have the natural resources of a Texas with oil, or a North Dakota, Wyoming with coal, and some of those natural gas. So Arizona's long-term plan to fund education has to be dependent on some kind of tax. I mean, you just have to – the elephant in the room is it has to be some kind of tax. Now, I had the opportunity to present to these 20 graduate students. All of them were principals or assistant superintendents. I said, okay, we're going to pretend that you're Doug Ducey. You have 1 hour to brainstorm on the best ways to fund Arizona education. And it was interesting because they threw out all the typical, well, let's just raise taxes. So, okay, let's drill down on that. What does that mean? That means we're no longer competitive when compared to other states on, say, corporate property tax, things like that. It's a much harder conversation. We've had some very, very smart people in Arizona since when Lisa was state superintendent work on this issue and not be able to come up with a long-term plan. Even Doug Ducey's is only 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, that, I don't know about that. That's why classrooms first, Rich. And so that conversation is about a long-term plan, and that is his counsel for exactly that. So the governor has two plans. One is immediate influx of money, how you do it. And he said that at the time. He said, look, this is the no-strings-attached piece of my agenda, which is I want to get more money into base funding right away. And I want to reform our system so we're pushing towards excellence. And one of the things we've got to confront, Steve, is Arizona spends a lot of money on the construction and property side. We have standard 20 acres in our district schools for elementary, 40 acres per high school, and we build every possible facility on a high school. We've got a lot of money, like around $1.5 billion out there every year that's going into construction bonds. The question is, how do we move a lot of this on a permanent basis, a lot of our expenditure into the classroom? Would we settle for great school buildings and maybe not everybody builds a football stadium? I mean, Arizona, no matter what we do, I agree with Rich, we have to tax ourselves for schools. But the way that we do that ought to be driving money into the school building itself, into the classroom itself, and most importantly, into teacher salaries, as Rich alluded to. We cannot keep doing everything we've always done and get the money where we need it to go.
That's a great point, Lisa. I appreciate you bringing that up. I had the opportunity to go tour one of the legacy charter schools here about 2 weeks ago. Fantastic building. Didn't have everything. It had a smaller gym, some of that. But it was interesting because it had about 1,100 students, gorgeous campus, small footprint. They talked about how they could have bought some more acreage for the playground, but it just didn't make sense. And I said to the owners and founders, I said, now, one of the challenges you guys have is you keep bringing lawmakers in and you're showing them a very well-performing school. Kids are happy. Teachers are qualified. And you have a nice building. And so lawmakers who walk through your school say, you're making it work. Why can't everybody? And very interesting.
Lisa, only a couple minutes left, and I want to have you and Rich both address this before we go. You mentioned classrooms first and whether that could be a long-term plan. One thing, and I don't want to paint this with too broad a brush, but there are a number of lawmakers who, again, whether it's raising taxes in any sense for this or whether where the spending is going to come from, whatnot, at some point, regardless of whether we want it to, the economy works in cyclical ways. We're going to hit another recession, hopefully not for a number of years, but when we do, is the long-term plan, whether it comes from classrooms first or something else, going to be strong enough so that there won't be sweeping and this kind of thing?
That's the goal, Steve. It absolutely is to have a rational, sustainable, predictable system that all schools can operate with. Governor has challenged us to create one funding system for all public schools. That'll be a first in Arizona. I think we can do it. Like I say, it'll be some exchanges. And you know what? You're going to have a diminishment possibly of some taxes over the long haul. You are going to have to potentially increase others. We're just going to have to be willing to grow up and talk about what the shape of this is.
Rich, are we going to grow up?
These are the elephant in the room is going to be bonds and overrides, and classrooms
first. You
mean
elephant, not donkey, right? That's what you're saying. Is that what you're saying?
For now, there are no D's on the radio right now, but they will be. But that's the big challenge. Is we're not willing to talk about how does that local property tax play into it, because it is such a personal issue for certain people.
Former State Senator Rich Crandall, he was also the head of the Wyoming Department of Education, and Lisa Graham Keegan is involved in education many levels, was the former Arizona State School Superintendent. Thank you both. We'll have to revisit this, of course, again and again. Have a great day. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last night in Las Vegas, we got our first real taste of the Democratic presidential candidates as they engaged in the initial debate of the campaign season. The five participants were Hillary Clinton, Lincoln Chafee, Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, and Jim Webb. And it took place as a lot of political watchers continue to wonder whether Vice President Joe Biden will declare himself a candidate for the nomination. Democratic consultant and strategist Bob Grossfeld of The Media Guys joins us with his observations on what did or did not happen on Tuesday night. Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. So, did Hillary Clinton come across as the front runner should? What impressed you about her performance?
She was confident. She came across as genuine and certainly was, I don't know how to put it, but open to her colleagues. She didn't go on the attack, with the exception of the gun control issue with Bernie Sanders, and certainly pointed to what the Democrats are interested in, which is fighting the Republicans. And she was the only one who did that.
But I want to come back to that genuine thing, though, just for a sec, which is, I mean, you've been in this business a long time. Regardless of what Secretary Clinton's resume looks like, her accomplishments, when someone is struggling to be genuine, at least that's the perception, how does one change that? How does she look more genuine?
Well, I think the way you do it is you just drop the pretense and you relax. And that's what I saw last night. It was a relaxed Hillary Clinton, and probably relaxed because of her confidence in her position.
Anything disappoints you about how she came across?
The only disappointment came when she fumbled on the email issue, and to a lesser extent, the Benghazi hearings. Although she handled the Benghazi question, I think, very well. And that's courtesy of the Republicans who, you know, have given her a get-out-of-jail card on that one.
What's the best overall outcome, Bob, coming out of last night's debate for the Democrats? Is it what you've said about Hillary Clinton performing strongly?
Well, I think that's part of it. But the other part of it is Democrats just being given a reason to feel confident. Between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, I think Democrats across the country are going to feel very, very good, and will get more involved than I think they might have, after watching the Republicans for a while.
I think the perception at this point is that Vice President Biden won't get in. But from your point of view, would he make it a better field? Is it too late?
Yeah, I think it's too late. And partially because of the performance last night, but also just because it's like the field is starting to settle in. And when you look at the numbers and the polling that's been done, all that Biden does is he takes support away from Clinton. And Bernie Sanders stays at a much higher level. Hmm. So in effect, Biden getting in would almost assure Bernie Sanders getting a whole heck of a lot of support.
I want to get your analysis of what Bernie Sanders has brought to this. Do you think his rise in the polls has strengthened Hillary Clinton? Has it forced her as well to address issues that maybe progressives want to hear more about? But is there the danger in that she comes across as someone who's modifying her positions too much? Not moderating, but modifying.
Yeah, I don't see it necessarily as, and I know a lot of the Washington pundits get into this nonsense, but I don't see it as forcing her to move to the right, to the left. And I think what Bernie has done is create an opportunity for Hillary and Democrats across the country to just be more genuine ourselves, to be the progressives that we really are. And to go into an area that all of the polling of voters and just non-voters, anybody across the country, say that they support from the Sanders position on the big banks and how the economic game is rigged to parental leave and on and on and on, free tuition for colleges. Those are things that when they're polled get incredible support. And I think just now Democrats are starting to realize that we don't need to run away from those things, that we can embrace those things and we'll do much better.
What do you think about what some critics have said, Bob, some progressive critics, that the field is not diverse enough? You have an African-American president now who came from the Democratic Party, but the candidates last night were all middle-aged white people.
Well, you know, I think it would have been great, but they didn't come forward. And you can't, you know, look at the field and say, well, let's grab somebody and stick him or her in there. You know, if there was a need for diversity on the part of anyone's part, they should have stepped up. And we just didn't see that. Now, having said that, there are many people of color who would make great candidates and exceptional presidents, but they didn't step up. And you can't make them do that.
Bob, finally, we know that Arizonans in the past have not voted for the Democratic presidential candidate very often, quite rarely. Do you see Hillary Clinton? Do you see Bernie Sanders? Maybe Vice President Biden? Are any of these people that could win a general election in Arizona?
Well, I hate to say it, but probably Jim Webb would have the best chance in Arizona after McCain's showing last time around. Seriously, though, Clinton can do well here. The issue will be whether the Hispanic vote comes in, whether the work that's been done over the last several years of doing voter registration and getting Latino young people involved in the system and attracting older Latinos to come out and actually participate. If that happens, yes, there's a chance.
Democratic consultant and strategist Bob Grossfeld of the Media Guys. Bob, thank you.
My pleasure.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about policymaking at the dinner table. How did Winston Churchill pull that off? And we'll talk with Arizona's poet laureate, Alberto Rios. Stay with us. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Earlier this year, we marked the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. One of the most prominent figures of that war was British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. In various documentaries and photos, it seems that Churchill often had a cigar in his hand or in his mouth, but I'm not sure many of us know what Churchill ate or how important the dinner table was to him. Sita Stelzer wrote about that and more in her book, Dinner with Churchill, Policymaking at the Dinner Table. She'll be the speaker with former Senator John Kyle as the moderator on Saturday night at the Camelback Inn. The event is being presented by the O'Connor Institute. And Sita Stelzer joins me now. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So was Winston Churchill a larger-than-life character as we often see him?
I think he was. I think that the Institute, the Sandra Day O'Connor Institute dinner on Saturday night is not just a fundraiser. It's a historically themed event. And the theme is December 1941, just after Pearl Harbor, Winston Churchill arrived for face-to-face meetings with President Roosevelt. Churchill felt that a face-to-face meeting was the best way to get to know his new ally. Mm-hmm. The British had been holding off Hitler for nearly 2 years before Pearl Harbor. So the Saturday night event will focus on these 3 weeks in which Churchill spent living at the White House, cheek by jowl, with the president.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book. And I know it's not brand new, but I'm really curious about the policymaking at the dinner table aspect of it. Is this something where Churchill felt like this was the best place for him to hold court? Was he a lover of food and drink? I don't know if all of us know much about that.
I think that he worked all the time. And he also used the lunch table and the dinner table as part of his meetings. It wasn't that he felt it was more important than conferences, but he felt he could prolong conversations. He certainly felt that if you sat down with somebody else, an ally or diplomats, that they would understand his position better, certainly fueled a little bit by relaxation and good food and an easy atmosphere. also, I think it was important that what he drank was important because it made people relaxed. And we're going on Saturday night at the Institute dinner, going to duplicate one of the menus of December 22nd, Christmas dinner, December 25th in 1941, that Roosevelt served to Churchill.
Well, can you give away a little bit of that? What's going to be on the menu?
It's a traditional Christmas style. They're two, we're not serving oysters.
Okay.
And apparently we're not flaming the plum pudding. Too dangerous. But Churchill was not so consumed with what he ate. He ate small portions. There are several people who work for him who are still alive who confirm this. He liked good, plain food, perfectly cooked. He didn't want to have anything to do with French sauces and fancy things. So the menu on Saturday night will be perfectly cooked, I'm sure.
Now, the skeptic might say, did he say he liked plain foods? Because especially during those times, he didn't want to act as though he was getting an opportunity to eat anything that was greater than the average person. Do we really think he did love English food? Because some would say English food is, you know, okay.
I think what happened for a man born in Blenheim, you don't think he would like plain food. But after his experience in the trenches in World War I, he saw and learned what ordinary British people were eating. And he ate the same things that they did when he was in the trenches during the war, First World War. And I think he got to like it better. He was very fastidious about the way it was prepared, but not about how much he ate or drank.
How important a figure, it's almost impossible to exaggerate how important a figure Churchill was during certainly the time of World War II. Based on the research you've done, the people you've talked to, has he become even greater in your eyes the more you've learned about him?
Well, last year there was a survey done by PricewaterhouseCoopers of 1,300 CEOs from 68 countries around the world. They all voted him number one in leadership. So that tells you something. Churchill is a hero in this country for lots of reasons. He remains a very important figure in British history as well.
Now, one of the things we often hear about the greater split among members of Congress and et cetera, partly has to do with the fact that maybe they have to come home to raise money, but also that there's more of a partisanship and they're not spending as much time together. Of course, the example that kept being brought up most recently was President Reagan and Speaker Tip O'Neill and the fact that maybe they didn't agree on things, but they would break bread together. Is what you've written about Churchill, should that apply more to today, that it's a way of at least getting to know adversaries or friends even better by sitting around the dinner table together in a time where you're not always in an office, you're not always on the floor together?
I think it would be very important to eliminate some of this partisanship that's in Washington now. Sandra Day O'Connor certainly felt very early on in her career that if she could invite people to her house and serve them Sonoran beef and discuss things, that issues could be resolved in that circumstance. Churchill certainly felt the same way. And it would be wonderful if we today in Washington, D.C., could have a little more of that, sharing a drink in the Capitol or at the White House, not formal dinners, but every night sitting around 10 or 12 people, it might work. Might help.
I wonder if we could use someone like Churchill to sort of bring something like that together, you know, like a leader who would say, okay, let's put aside our differences and just enjoy some good food and some good drink, or bland food and drink, whichever the case may be.
I wish it would happen.
And as you mentioned, Sandra Day O'Connor with the O'Connor Institute, one of the things that she has tried to create is this idea of bipartisanship, the people talking amongst each other about different things. We're talking with Sita Stelzer right now. She's the author of the book Dinner with Churchill, Policymaking at the Dinner Table. She will be the speaker with former Senator John Kyle as the moderator Saturday night at the Camelback Inn, and the event is being presented by the O'Connor Institute. I do want to come back a little bit more, if we could, to just get into some specifics of, did Churchill, based on his background, was he someone who ever liked to cook himself? Was he someone who, or was it always put it in front of me and I will eat it?
No, he did not. He had servants all his life. He once said, he once threatened his wife, Clemmy, that he would go to Chartwell, his country house, and cook himself an egg. And she said, you don't know how. And he said, I've seen it done. So he was not a cook at all. I think the important thing to remember is that the big dinners that Churchill had with Presidents Roosevelt and Truman and with Stalin those throughout the war were critical, the big international conferences, where Churchill got a lot done by not only during the day when the staffs were meeting together, but at the dinner tables.
When you're talking about people like FDR and Truman and Stalin, I mean, these are obviously some of the most famous people in history. Did he have a tendency at all, do we know, to dine with other people at a, let's say, a lower level, folks that he would talk to as well, but it was the same sort of effect that he would have with some of the larger people?
I don't think he and Clemmie, his wife, ever had a single dinner, just the two of them together, except on their honeymoon. He always had, both at Chequers, which is the Prime Minister's country house, and at Chartwell, his own country house, always had at least 10 or 15 people. It included members of his family, included his children very often. It included military staff. He always had foreign guests, very often people like Harry Hopkins, Averell Harriman, and he had Ivan Maisky, who was the Soviet ambassador to London for many years. He always was at the table. So Churchill included everybody. It was a way that Churchill received information. He had no CNN those days. So, for instance, Averell Harriman had just come back from meeting with Stalin in 1942. The best way for Churchill to find out what had happened, what was going on, was to have him to dinner and find out. And he would include the military staffs always, both American and British.
Finally, did you feel like it was easier to relate to Churchill on this level? Did it humanize him to learn more about how he did this policymaking at the dinner table?
I think it added a different facet to this hero. Certainly, we all know his humor and his quotes, but this made him very human. And certainly, there isn't anybody in the country who would not like to have dinner with Churchill.
Sita Stelzer is the author of the book Dinner with Churchill, Policymaking at the Dinner Table. You can see her Saturday night at the Camelback Inn at an event being presented by the O'Connor Institute. Sita, thank you for being here, and welcome as a new resident of Phoenix.
Thank you very much.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. 2 years ago, Alberto Rios became Arizona's first poet laureate. He's still going strong in that position, and he has a brand new book of poetry. It's called A Small Story About the Sky. He's also the host of KAET's Books and Company, and Alberto Rios joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back, Steve.
So your poetry generates a rich variety of emotions, and I'm wondering, is there an emotion that you feel the most when you have written or felt a poem that truly affected you the most?
I you know, it's a funny thing to think about it in those terms, but if I had to give it a word, it's joy. You have brought something into the world. It's not like a child, obviously, but it has a variation on that theme. It is bringing something new into the universe, kicking and screaming, and yet there it is, and perfectly formed.
Well, that was one of the reasons I thought, and obviously I know very little about poetry, Alberto, forgive me, but I feel like when you were selected as poet laureate, there was that feeling that you are someone who generates that joy in others. It seems like you get such pleasure from what you do, and that's genuine.
Well, I think it is. I think that's the whole point. I'm not there to lecture anybody. I don't speak in red ink. I'm there to share some observations and generally have a reasonably good time, even though that's an odd thing today to think about on the page. But you can do it.
Right. So how much has the desert, how much has Arizona been a muse for you?
Well, Arizona is my muse. And I grew up in Nogales. I was born there and I grew up there. And so I lived not only in an Arizona small town, but also on the border and in the desert, you know, just placed in the great, wild, wonderful Sonoran Desert. And I have to say, I think my poems balance between those things. I don't ignore one over the other. So all my books have a helping of the Sonoran Desert, a helping of the border, a helping of small town, and I think it's a good mesh.
Do you recall when poetry really spoke to you for the first time?
Sure, only it wasn't called that. It was simply called Words I Want to Remember, and it probably happened to me in fourth grade, fifth grade, and it had nothing to do with anything I was doing in school. I would hear things, and we all have an impulse toward taking care of what matters to us. And for me, as I heard things that seemed intrinsically meaningful or I had never heard before, they just shocked me or surprised me, I wanted to take care of them. And so I went to what turns out to be the most dangerous place a kid can go, the back of your notebook. You know, the front of your notebook is where you're supposed to be doing your homework. The back of your notebook, you go there, you're looking for trouble. You're going to tear out a piece for a spit wad. You're going to write a note to somebody. You're going to do something. But it's also the portal that you go back there and you can go anywhere and do anything and think whatever you want in words. And it was very powerful. And I started just simply writing words down. And I know now that was me. That was the beginning of me writing.
Did you know at the time that felt, did it feel different to you, I guess I'm wondering? Because did you have other examples? Yeah,
different for probably not good reasons. Yeah. I had begun by getting in trouble for daydreaming early on, like second grade.
Terrible
so
thing.
I was a known daydreamer, had a rap sheet, you know. And when I started writing in the backs of my notebooks, what I recognized pretty early on is that I wasn't doing it for a teacher. I didn't know what teacher to even show it to. It was not anything having to do with English class. That kind of poetry, you know, whatever we were reading had no bearing on what I was doing, which was very different. I wasn't doing it for my parents. I wasn't doing it to try and get a date with a girl or something, you know, yeah. Do something like that. And so I really ended up not showing it to anybody. And it became incredibly personal in that way. I wasn't doing it for a grade. I wasn't doing it to please my parents. I wasn't doing it, you know, to do something with my friends. And so I also knew that if I did show it, it would mark me as someone different. Mm. And so I kept it all to myself, and I didn't know what to call it. And we all have various secrets. This was my secret. And it was powerful as a result of that. And as the words started growing and growing, that secret started getting bigger and bigger. And it was a useful thing to me. It's strange now to go into schools and say, no, show your writing, do this. When in fact, I realized I wasn't doing it for anybody except me. Mm-hmm. That was a great lesson to myself. I wasn't using it or you know, leveraging it for anything except the intrinsic need, want, joy of doing it.
Well, as poet laureate, yes, when you go to classrooms or you speak with younger people, can you say both of those things? Can you say don't be shy, but if you are shy about it, that's okay.
I say exactly that, and I tell them this story, and I say I didn't come to it by somebody talking to me. I had to invent, I really believe this, I had to invent poetry for myself. It was not a received genre. I didn't get it through books. I had to invent it for myself. That made it part of my core being, and it's something I carry forward. And I love talking to kids about that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be what you read in books. You get to say what it should be, and it's an important part of, you know, how you imagine yourself.
So how have these couple of years been as poet laureate?
Oh, they've been very, very busy and wonderful, and not according to how it ought to have gone. I've gotten to invent this job, and I think the legislation said I had to do 6 things and then a big project. Well, I did 6 things, I swear to God, the first day, and it has been nonstop ever since. And the idea of a big project I've come to see now at the end of this first term is exactly the wrong way to have done it. If I were to have done a big project, that's where all our attention would have gone. What my big project, what I'm going to call it, and the way I want to describe it is poetry of 1,000 encounters. I want every single conversation I've had with anybody along the way, and this has been quite a voyage, to be part of the big project. I want it all to matter. I want it all to count. So I don't think a big one-night performative event is the way to go. I want to elevate it all up to that level and say, you all count. We all did this together.
Now, you have a new book of poetry out called A Small Story About the Sky, and I don't know if anyone, we're down to just a minute or so left, but I want to mention Books and Company.
Yes.
On Channel 8, the UDK AET.
Yes.
And that, again, that's why coming back to joy. When you interview an author, it is, you're so enthusiastic and charismatic about it. Do you love the craft of writing regardless of who's doing the writing?
Oh, absolutely. There's something magical about it. And I have to say, something like Books and Company is a dying breed. Authors don't get to talk about their work anymore. You get onto a show somebody comes up to you and you say, so, I hear you've written a book. You know, they haven't read it and you've got 1 minute to talk about it. This is the opposite of that. I love talking about that. Writing gives us plenty to talk about.
Is there a particular genre that has hit you that you didn't especially love before, but maybe from doing the program?
Popularized science. So just reading some things about the great beyond us, whatever that is, and how we have actually been there and done the things that we've done. I have to say that's impressed me.
Alberto Rios is Arizona's Poet Laureate. He also has a new book of poetry out called A Small Story About the Sky, and he'll be signing copies of it at Changing Hands Bookstore on October the 21st, Phoenix or Tempe?
Tempe.
In the Tempe store, that's October the 21st. Alberto, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.